I would even take it a step further and say, you can always go back to a crappy job.
Yeah.
Because I have so many people that are like, oh, I hate my job. It's so crappy and stuff. Should I go somewhere else? I'm like, yes, just go somewhere else. I mean, you will always find another crappy job if this one, if this doesn't work out. I mean, what's the benchmark you're coming from? What's the baseline? You have nothing to lose, right? Salut, ihr Moneypennies, herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Podcast-Folge. Boah, heute habe ich was Spezielles für euch. Wie einige von euch sicherlich wissen, bin ich großer Fan von John Strelecki, habe seine Bücher gelesen, halte die auch immer wieder an alle möglichen Kameras. Und wenn ihr mich nach Buchempfehlungen fragt zum Thema Persönlichkeitsentwicklung, Bücher, die mein Leben verändert haben, kommen seine immer an erster Stelle. Und eines Tages vor ein paar Wochen hat mich tatsächlich eine Community-Managerin von ihm angeschrieben auf Instagram, ob ich nicht Lust hätte, in Johns Podcast zu kommen. Und ich so, wie jetzt, ist das jetzt ein Fake? Ist das der John Strelecki? Hab's erst gar nicht richtig für voll genommen, bis ich es dann realisiert habe, doch, es ist genau er. Und dann so diese Gedanken, hä, warum soll ich in seinem Podcast, was will er denn von mir? Warum fragt er mich denn, was kann ich denn für einen Beitrag leisten? Also sehr schön Imposter-Syndrom at its best. Ich habe es aber natürlich trotzdem gemacht. Also ich war bei John Strelecki im Podcast. Für mich immer noch eine total, ja, unreale Situation, auch jetzt rückblickend. Ich weiß nicht, ob ihr es kennt, wenn man so hart konzentriert ist, dass man gar nicht mehr so richtig weiß, worüber man eigentlich gesprochen hat. Das war so bei mir der Fall. Ich war so drin im Tunnel und so hart in dieses Gespräch mit ihm eingetaucht. Danach hat mich jemand gefragt, ja, worüber habt ihr denn geredet? Ich so, ich kann es dir nicht sagen. Ich war so konzentriert, so fokussiert. Alles andere wurde, also ich weiß nicht, ich habe es nicht abgespeichert. Lirum larum, ihr hört es jetzt hier nochmal. Wir sprechen unter anderem darüber, was selbst mit Geld ausgeben zu tun hat, was wir von unseren Kindern gelernt haben, John und ich, warum du nichts verlieren kannst, wenn du deinen beschissenen Job verlässt und noch ganz, ganz vieles mehr. Also es lohnt sich wirklich unheimlich. Es ist natürlich auf Englisch. War nochmal eine Herausforderung für mich. Bitte lacht mich nicht aus. Von daher, genau, zieht's euch rein auf Englisch, John Strelecki und ich. Genau, und bevor es endgültig losgeht, freue ich mich natürlich, wenn ihr hier diesen Podcast, nämlich den meinigen und natürlich super gerne auch sein, bewertet und vielleicht einen netten Kommentar da lasst. Ihr kennt den Joke, 12 von 5 Sternen, freuen wir uns am meisten drüber. Und jetzt aber erstmal sehr, sehr viel Spaß und eine große Portion Inspiration von John Strelecki und meiner Wenigkeit Natascha Wegelin in dieser Podcast-Folge. Viel Spaß.
Hello, Natascha. How are you?
Oh my gosh, John. So, I can't even say, I'm so honored to be here. Thank you so much. Oh, I'm having goosebumps right now. Like, honestly, I'm having
goosebumps right now. That's awesome.
Oh, wow.
I've been looking forward to this call, so I'm excited to hear that you're excited about it.
Oh, I'm so excited. I don't think I've slept last night at all. Okay, tomorrow's the day. I've read all your books. They changed my life. Probably everyone tells you that, but it's, can't believe it that I'm here right now talking to you live on your podcast.
Thank you. Wow. Well, right back at you. I'm always very curious. How did you find or discover my books? What was the first one that you read? And did you find it? Did it find you? Did someone give it to you?
That's a very good question. I think the first one was The Big Five. And I think somebody gave it to me like years and years ago. Or I saw it somewhere and I think I didn't even read it at first. You know, when you get a book and you're like, I don't even know, and put it on the shelf. Right. And then, but I truly believe that books find you in the perfect moment of time. And then I started with this one and then Café am Rande der Welt on all these. And interestingly enough, I gave birth last year around this time. And again, people started giving me your books for that matter. And I was like, okay, I've read them all, but it was so interesting that, you know, they found me again, like during that, like very special time in my life. So
that is awesome. Yeah. That's awesome. The crazy thing is that we're always changing. I know there's certain books that I like to go back to and read again and again. And when I read them, it feels like the content has changed. I know that's not true. It's that I've changed. And so I read the content differently. I absorb different pieces of it that I didn't before.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's the real magic about books, and also about the magic, like about books on personal growth, especially, I think.
Yeah. So as you said, I have some books that I read like every year again and again, and I put my little marks on it, you know, in blue and in yellow and in green. So I know that every time I read it, I can see, oh, that was interesting to me last year. Apparently it doesn't even matter this year. So it's really interesting to see the progress, like to see my progress through books as well.
That's a cool way of doing it, where you make the marks in different colors, actually. I've never heard of that before, but I really like that idea.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Is there so throw me one title that you go back to, and or you have gone back to over the years?
Yeah, one is definitely The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck.
Yeah, yeah.
By Mark Manson. That's one of those. It's okay. Like totally torn apart. Like my copy of it is, I really work through that every year.
That's
like,
great.
You know, it's also on personal growth and stuff. So.
That's great.
Cool self-help.
Well, there's been an evolution in self-help, and I think there's been an evolution in the field of personal finance too, which is, you know, what worked for people 20, 30 years ago, the formatting, the style, all the rest of that may not be as applicable today. And so I think that's one of the things as content creators for us to do is say, okay, I mean, you got to be authentic in your brand. You have to be authentic in the way that you deliver what you want.
Yeah.
But I think it's also important to look at the market of people that you're serving and saying, where are they at in their life? What's different compared to 20 happening? Or 30 years ago?
Yeah, exactly. And we like in the personal finance topic, we do see a shift that, you know, people know more nowadays than they knew 10 years ago because of YouTube and because of, you know, stuff I do. So they're more advanced once they come to us, for example, like compared to 10 years ago.
That's interesting. And I would also imagine then there's the risk of, because there is so much information out there, how do they filter what is authentic information and coming from a good place as opposed to someone who's just trying to get them to commit $100 or $200 or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Especially for women, actually, because I call it like the femme finance washing, where, you know, people are at, I don't know, financial advisors, also coaches and stuff. They started seeing what we did with Madame Moneypenny, because we were the first to like really address women in personal finance. And they saw that, oh, this works. I just call it women finance something.
Right.
Still the same stuff you don't want to have.
Yeah.
You don't want to invest in. But since it's pink now, we can sell it better to women. So, and there's, that's a not so nice development where people just jump on the train and,
Yeah, I want to unpack that a little bit and talk about that. But when you said that, just make it pink, that's been one of the, so I have a daughter, she's now 16. And she was actually one of the first, I noticed it, but I didn't really point it out or say anything about it. And I can't remember how old she was, but she was like 5 or 6 or something. She said, "Dad, why do they think they can just paint it pink and all of a sudden it's for me now?" I was like, I know what you're saying, kid.
Too.
Yeah. She has pointed that out to me numerous times, that the exact same product when painted pink will actually go up in price by about 20%.
Yeah, exactly. I think the most common example is razors.
Mm-hmm.
So razors for men are way cheaper than pink razors for women, like way more expensive. And you're like, it's three blades. Like, why?
It's the exact
same
thing.
That's the same stuff. So
I don't think the red pigmentation color costs you guys more. So,
exactly.
But that actually goes into, I think, the essence of what you teach. And so we can just start unpacking this all now, which is that at the end of the day, the system is going to be what the system is. The question is, how do you operate within the system so that you get to live the life that you want to live? And so if the razors that are exactly the same are €3 or more because they're pink, then you have a decision to make about whether you're going to support that and buy it, or whether you're going to buy the ones that are blue and just use those. And I think that little decision, although that's sort of laughable in the context of what we're talking about, the essence of that is actually the same, that you have to be the one who charts your own path in this story, because everybody else, I mean, there are people who are looking out for you. I know you are very compassionate. You do a great job of serving your community. I very much care about the people that I serve in my community.
Yeah.
But there are plenty of people out there whose job is really, in their essence, is really to not do that. And so at the end of the day, it's going to come down to you and your personal desires and needs, wishes, et cetera. And you got to chart your own path. And that's what I saw so much when I was looking about you and the work that you do. So I'm very curious, going back in time in the time machine to for Natasha's childhood, like, did you understand that stuff at a heart level from the time that you were a little kid? Was there a defining moment, not just for finance, because I want to talk about that too, but about life in general, about charting your own course?
I think, like, going back to, like, gender stereotypes, it hit me, like, pretty early in childhood because I was very much into soccer.
Okay.
And soccer, different than in the US, in Europe, it's a boy sport.
Mm-hmm.
So I found myself, like, in the middle of just, like, boys who didn't really like for me to be there because I was good, probably better than them. And the parents didn't like that as well and stuff. So I was like, okay, why is this for boys? And I'm a girl and I don't fit in. So what? I just wanted to play soccer. You know, I
didn't care about all that stuff. Right. You're a kid, right?
Yeah, I was a kid. I was like seven, like, leave me alone. And yeah, but that's, you know, you can call it, like, that was a system I was in. It was a boys' sports. I could have decided to, okay, I just go out. It's too much stress for me. I don't want to do this. The system is not for me. But this was not me as a little kid. It's not me now. And it wasn't me as a little kid
love
already.
That. Yeah.
So I was like, no, I just want to play soccer. And I was like, really, like, they were mobbing me. I was an outsider and stuff. But it was about this sports that I loved so much. Like, this passion, I was so passionate about, and I wanted to do nothing else all day. I was like, okay, I'm, you know, this is a system I'm in, but I'm deciding to keep going because it's so worthy for me. It's so much worth to me to play soccer nonetheless. So, and yeah, that was definitely a defining moment in, or a time of my life that defined my view on the world and probably lots of my personality.
And do you distinctly remember that? Because you're saying you were like seven at the time, which is pretty young.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you have very specific memories of what it was
totally.
And how you felt at the time.
Right. And I think that's exactly why I remember it so much, because it was emotionally so intense.
Mm.
Right. Like you remember the emotional moments in your life more than, you know, it doesn't really matter.
Right.
So, and I actually played through until I was like 30 years old or 32 or so. Of course, then in girls' teams and in women's teams. But it's, you know, it kind of became a big part of my life.
I love that. Well, actually, one of the friends of the show is Manu Zinsberger, who's been one of our guests. And she's
nice.
A very famous goalkeeper for professional soccer leagues over in Europe. So I love that. I love that. And she described very similar that, you know, she was playing on boys' teams and people would make comments and the rest of that. And it's really interesting because as you described that, and I'm thinking about what, like, I'm sort of visualizing that scene take place. Here you are, a little kid, you're 7, 8 years old, et cetera. And parents have an issue with the fact that there's a girl on their field playing against their boys. And you can see in that moment how it's their issue. Like, it has nothing to do with you.
Yeah, totally.
But of course, you're the recipient of it. Yeah, you'd think that they would get it, right? Yeah.
Get your stuff together. Like, what's going on? It wasn't even the kids. It wasn't even the boys in the first place. Of course, then the parents started going nuts. And then the kids were like, oh, yeah, right. You're a girl. I don't like you anymore. It's like, what? Why?
Right.
Just because your mom said so.
Yeah. Which is a very powerful observation that's so often. And I think that's one of the big things that as adults we have the opportunity to think about for ourselves is what beliefs do you hold and why do you hold them? And because as you're saying, I find that children in particular, they get along great together. They don't have these preconceived perceptions of like, oh, you look that way and I look this way, so therefore I like you or don't like you, or like this is what that means. They're very much more accommodating and accepting, et cetera, which leads me to believe that it really is conditioning, that it's someone who tells them, well, no, like that shouldn't be the way it is. And then they embrace that for whatever reason.
Yeah, definitely. I think so too. There's this very cute video. Maybe you saw that. I think it's from BBC even. And they asked couple of friends of kids where you could actually see, like, everyone sees a difference. Like, one kid is sitting in a wheelchair, or one kid has glasses and the other one doesn't. And they asked those kids, what's the biggest difference between you guys? And they're like, he likes ketchup and I don't. And it's so cute because, you know, they don't care.
Right.
They just don't care. It's just, we are friends. Like, what difference are you talking about? So, and that's such a striking video.
I love
also,
that.
To your point. Yeah.
I love that. Well, so congratulations, first of all, on being a mom.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. It's not for everybody. And I say that when I talk to people about being a parent. I don't think it's everyone's path. And if they don't feel called to do it, I don't think they should do it. Because it is a ton of giving, which you don't typically see in the advertisements or in the videos. It looks like in the videos and the advertisements, like you're just going to get this love bomb that drops into your life and they're just going to give love to you. It's going to be amazing. And the reality, of course, in the first 2 years especially, is it's really the opposite. You're the caretaker. You're taking endless hours to make sure that this tiny little human has everything they possibly need, and they don't even have the means to communicate back to you.
Yeah, right.
But that said, when I look back over my life, and I love all the other stuff that I've done with the books, et cetera, but it is the single greatest thing ever. Like, I just have loved being a dad.
Yeah, I feel the same, like exactly the same. I think I've mentioned it on my last podcast somewhere where I said, like, I've done pretty cool stuff in my life. You know, I've traveled, I've written books, I've, you know, helped a lot of women, you know, achieve financial independence and stuff. But this is like it's a different game. It's a different level on like everything you can ever imagine. Like, and people always say, yeah, I learned so much about myself. I was like, really? Do you when you become a parent? And now I'm like, oh my God, I learned so much. it's crazy. Like, I thought I knew myself well, but now it's, again, also on this notion, a totally, totally different game. And it's,
kudos to you for being open to that, because I think that is a huge acceptance that as an adult, I don't know everything and I'm willing to learn even from tiny little human.
Yeah, definitely. And I love how, my baby actually like digs deeper and deeper and deeper, you know, pushes the right buttons where I'm like, okay, that's a pattern right here. I can see my pattern. Where is this coming from? And then I try to analyze like my childhood and stuff. So it's really, for me, it's also the biggest personal growth experience of everything I've done before. And this was also like one little part of the motivation to become a mom, actually, to say, wow, that's gonna be a total different me in a total different game. And I just love to join this roller coaster and ride with it, with all the highs and lows, and see where it takes me. And so far, I can say that it's like, before I thought it was really productive. I thought it was really efficient. I thought I had my stuff together. And now it's like, wow, what am I actually capable of?
Mm-hmm.
What was my body capable of? I mean, I've done everything I've done before as well during the pregnancy, right? I worked, I went to the gym, I did my interviews, I did my stuff around the house and stuff. But while building a human being inside me, it's so crazy. Like all the things I did before, I thought, oh, wow, that my limit is right here.
Right.
I did all the stuff while building a human. And now I do pretty much all the stuff while nurturing a human and being also emotionally available and stuff. So that's one of a kind experience. But I'm totally on you at this point. Like if you don't feel like it, you shouldn't do it.
Right. Yeah. It's like with most things in life, it's got to be for the right reason. It's in alignment with the life that you want to live, as opposed to you're counting on this other thing filling the box that is empty in your life.
Yeah, exactly. And I was actually at this point that I was like sitting at home and be like, you know, my life is pretty awesome right now. So, and I think that's a good place to come from, to make good life decisions, to say, okay, I'm so happy right now. My life is pretty great. I've checked a lot of boxes, and this would be even greater. This would be an extension of the greatness and not something is missing. I need to fill the hole, because that doesn't work. And
I think that's a difference in our times now too, because we are at a unique point in history where you don't have to get married at 17 and you don't start having babies at 14 or 15. Like that was a big piece of the human story throughout our millions of years on the planet. And now, when I talk to younger folks who are in their 20s, et cetera, and I say, gosh, you know, if I had any piece of advice for you, it would be exactly what you just said, Natasha, which is figure out yourself first. Like go on those big adventures that you want to have. Get yourself solidly checking the box on all the things that you wanted to do and solidly set financially. Because then when you have your kid, you're going to be in a much better place to be the parent that you want to be. You know, you're not going to you're not going to have as many of those triggers that we were talking about. They'll still be there, but you'll be able to observe them from a place of curiosity and like, huh, isn't that interesting? As opposed to, you know, they do something and you fly off the handle at them, which is what you see a lot of parent-child relationships look like. And so it's a very special gift that we're in terms of this moment in history. And if people take the opportunity to leverage that, it can be, I think it can really enhance all aspects of their life, including the parenting part.
Yeah, definitely. And also what you just said, like the financial part of it. I have so many pregnant women in my program because they're like, okay, I'm pregnant now and I need to figure this stuff out now before the baby arrives. And I'm like, that's so smart. Yeah, it's such a good point of time to say, and I think it just comes, I had those feelings too. I was like, okay, what do I need to take care of for 9 months now? Like, what's my list? And do also the financial planning and the savings or whatever, do it beforehand. And make a plan, because it's also like, I think common knowledge that also financial stress, financial problems tear you down so, so much.
Right.
And it's so stressful to know that there's debt or that there's, I don't like, we don't have enough savings for XYZ, I don't know. Or always be like on the tipping point to, does it really, you know, is it really enough? And that's a really big factor of stress.
Yeah, and that's going to carry over into the whole family dynamic. The constellation is going to look very different if that's every day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I want to bring you back. We've been heading in a lot of different tangents, which is awesome because I love conversations that go that way. I do have 4 pages of questions for you.
I would love to get to them.
And so
it's like, okay.
Yeah, I hope you've got 6 hours blocked off, Natasha. We might be here a while. One of the things I love in doing the show is the fact that we do head off on unexpected directions and tangents as I get to know people and their stories. And so I want to go back a tiny bit before we leap forward into all of these questions that I'd prepared in terms of there you are as this kid, you found your passion in soccer. You're succeeding in that. You're noticing the social dynamics of how strange people can be. Were you aware of the path that you wanted to walk as a human being when you were a teenager heading into university? Did your parents, when you look back over your life now, did your parents have the wherewithal or the background in their story that they were able to set you up for success in that way? Or were you charting your own path completely in these kind of things?
So I think during my teenage years, I didn't know much. Didn't know much what I wanted to do. I didn't know much about myself. It was all kind of loose. I thought I would be, you know, headed towards like the corporate career.
Okay.
You know, get a degree and, you know, go into marketing and then become head of and whatever, CMO and stuff. But then along the way... Well, actually, I actually like then started economics and marketing and stuff. So it was, you know, I was set. I was all set to go that path, could go down that path. But then I heard about something like, oh, I can work for myself instead of working for others. So that sounds interesting.
And do you remember how you heard about that?
I think it was one of those like situations as a teenager, close to graduation, and like, so what do you want to study? For some reason, it was so clear in my whole family that I'm going to university, and I don't know where that comes from because my parents didn't.
Okay.
But maybe, you know, maybe it's like the next steps, the next generation.
Yeah.
Exactly, which is kind of unconscious. probably like, of course you're going to study. And then for me, it's like, of course I'm going to study. And I was like, so what am I going to study? What am I going to study? And we had these huge books with like, where universities had their advertisement. I'm like, okay, what you can study here and there. And I found some entrepreneurial school. I was like, okay, that's very interesting. So I read through that. It's like, yeah, that kind of sounds like me. Gives me a lot of options. You know, I can then go to the corporate career, but also I was hoping to be set up for a non-corporate career. So I was like, that sounds good. Let's do that. But there's no entrepreneurial background in my family whatsoever. So I'm really the first one to start their own businesses.
Well, I like that piece of your story, yeah. Especially as it relates to something that I see very often, which is young people more and more these days at a younger age are being asked that question. And the people who are asking the question expect them to have a perfectly clear answer. And yeah. So I'm not sure how we've transitioned to this point, but why do we expect at 15, 16 that kids have a clear path of the rest of their life when most adults don't have that? I think it's completely unrealistic, and it puts way too much pressure on these young people. And so I love the fact that what I hear in your story, and correct me if there's pieces of this that I didn't get correctly, but yours was a very intuitive decision-making process. You said, oh, that sounds interesting. That feels interesting when you connected with this entrepreneurship thing. And then you had the courage to walk down that path, even though you didn't have necessarily a role model that was in your story, your family, your neighbors, whatever. So that, I think, is an awesome piece of advice for young people is what feels right to you right now? What's calling to you?
Exactly. Plus, like, fast forward 20, 30, 40 years, there's going to be different jobs than there are now. If you ask a little girl, a little boy, like what do you want to be when you grow up, it's like they might name a job that doesn't even exist then anymore.
Yeah.
So rather than asking them for a job description, I don't know, maybe it would be better to ask them like, what are your interests? What are you interested in? What problems are you interested in solving in the future or anything, rather than saying like, I want to be a lawyer because 20 years, maybe there are no lawyers anymore because it's all
AI has taken your job. Thanks very much.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a huge challenge for the kids today.
Yeah. So you had the entrepreneurial calling, you felt it, you followed that path. Clearly it was a good decision because, although you did work in corporate America for a little while, as I understand it, when you were in your 20s, is that true?
Yeah, right. Actually, my first job was a like pretty standard corporate job in marketing and product management in Hamburg, Germany. And I did that, I think, for 2 years before starting my own company. So yeah, I kind of, you know, needed the safety maybe at first, which I think it's still a good process, you know, to go to a corporate company and see like how is stuff going, like how does working work, like what are processes, what jobs are there, how can I work with people together, like what's my network and stuff. So for me, it was a perfect way to actually dig in there, and then I learned a lot from that. And also learned that that's not for me, right? So then I switch over to the entrepreneur side. And I think that's perfectly fine, you know, to try different stuff.
Yeah, it can be a great thing.
Especially in your 20s, like you have nothing to lose.
And you might have always wondered like, oh, maybe I should have, right? But now, now you know exactly what that looked like and felt like.
Yeah.
And so did you know literally from the, I don't know, first day, first month, you're like, okay, I'm going to do this for a little while, but this is not me. Or at what point did that sort of kick in for you?
I think it took me probably like a year or so. In the beginning, I actually liked it, you know, like I learned so much in very, very little time. But that's mostly the point. Like when I feel like I don't learn as much anymore, I get bored quite quickly. And this doesn't happen in entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
Like, it never gets boring. Like,
it'll be the opposite of that for everyone out there who's listening and saying, I want to be an entrepreneur.
Sometimes a balance would be nice. But
there is never a shortage of potential joint ventures, partnerships, things you can learn, expansions. Yeah, very, very true.
Exactly. And then economic crisis and all that stuff.
Yes.
You can feel safe in your micro environment and think, I have it all figured out. And then something comes from the outside, from the macro, and you're like, oh, God damn it.
Yeah, Apple's going to change the iOS approach that they have. And suddenly your connection between Facebook followers and iOS goes away completely.
Exactly.
Right? Exactly. And half your business goes away. Yeah, it's so true that the world of entrepreneurship. And so if someone's not wired for that, if that doesn't fit their risk thresholds, then corporate America is probably a better fit.
Right. And you can always go back. You know, I think there's a lot of pressure also, like once you go into entrepreneurship, you have to be successful and you have to stay there. You need to be a true entrepreneur. And I'm like, well, if it's not for you, if you feel bad, if you can't sleep, it's too stressful, then don't do it. There's nothing wrong with like a corporate job. Go and do what makes you happy. So you don't have to do what other people do.
It's, you know, it sounds so simple when you say it. And I love that expression, you can always go back. We talk about that a lot in the context of if you decide to follow your big five for life and one of them is travel around the world, and then you're 6 months into the experience and you decide, oh, I thought I wanted to sail, but in truth, I don't want to sail. I want to do something else. Right. Great.
Yeah.
Go back to whatever. You can always go back. And I know that for somebody who's listening, this might be a major aha moment. And it was for me the first time I realized that, yes, you can do that. If you're good at what you do, you're passionate about what you do. Actually, you don't even have to be that good at it, quite honestly, because if you look at the marketplace in general, if you're operating at about a 60% productivity level, you can probably get and keep a job. So you don't even have to be that great at it. And so you might as well be more courageous. You might as well be bold in trying new things because you can always go back.
Yeah, exactly. And I would even take it a step further and say, you can always go back to a crappy job.
Yeah.
Because I have so many people that are like, oh, I hate my job. It's so crappy and stuff. Should I go somewhere else? I'm like, yes, just go somewhere else. I mean, you will always find another crappy job if this doesn't work out. I mean, what's the benchmark you're coming from? What's the baseline? You have nothing to lose, right?
That'll be the new inspirational poster on the walls, right? It's like, you know, you have the ones that are like freedom and the ones that are like teamwork. This will be like, crappy jobs will always exist.
Yeah. And you will always find one.
Yeah. Don't worry. You can always go to one of those, right? Exactly. That should be very, very inspiring.
Nothing to lose.
Yeah. Nothing to lose. I love that. I have to say that when I was reading through your materials, I'm actually getting to some of my formal questions here. Which are things that I absolutely want to make sure that I ask you about. I feel like there is such a kindred spirit in some of the things that you write about and some of the things you talk about. And I'm curious to know how you arrived at your awareness of these things. For example, in the Cafe on the Edge of the World, or Das Café am Rande der Welt, there is an entire section where the character of Anne talks about the power of the marketing world and how if we're not careful, what keeps us from living the life we want, and instead we just keep looking and hoping for that time in the future when we can finally retire and then go live the life we want, what keeps us there is this potential downward spiral that we enter, where we get sucked into the marketing messages of the almost $1 trillion worldwide now that is spent on marketing, to believe that our fulfillment, our happiness, our joy will actually come from some random product or service that somebody else has out there. And for me, one of the big things that totally changed that was leaving everything behind when I was 32, going backpacking around the world. And I was never, ever happier in my life than when I had literally next to nothing except what could fit between my butt and my head and my backpack. But I was out there living the life that I wanted. And so that was my defining experience, which really cemented that. I'm very curious to know for you, where did this awareness come from? Was it a defining moment? Was it a progressive series of moments? How did you come to this state of awareness?
Well, I don't have such a nice story as yours.
Okay.
I wish I had. But no, for me, it was actually more, I don't think it was a defining moment. It was more like process, you know, to actually dig in there. And it was through actually my money journey that I was experiencing, okay, there's so much more in my power than I thought. You know, when I took over this corporate job, it's like I was making money for the first time in my life and I spent it all. First job syndrome, I call it that. The first job syndrome is like, I am rich. Right. I'm going to buy this watch and go this. Right.
This is amazing. Every week they just deposit money into my account. It's crazy. Yeah.
Exactly. And it wasn't even that much money, right? It's just for me back then, it was like, wow, I'm really rich. And then I came across this whole financial independence, retire early. I don't even know how exactly I came across that, probably some YouTube channel or whatever. And that was the beginning of my journey to actually see, okay, money comes in, but it doesn't have to go out. Mm. I can actually, keep some.
Yeah.
And I mean, probably all of us know this one person or even several that like earn 100K and they spend 100K.
Right. Or 105. So,
exactly. At least 100K, correct. And somehow I grasped this concept, like, okay, even if I make just 30,000 a year, I don't have to spend it all. I can like spend 20 and keep 10. And I think this changed also my view on marketing, to actually taking this power back. Like, you're getting sucked into this marketing stuff, and the marketing nowadays is so good. Yeah.
Right.
So good. Oh. Like, you would buy eventually if you don't have your stuff together.
Yeah. Oh, look at this. So, she's interested in unicorns that have a stripe on the side. Next thing you know, you're going to get 100 ads and versions of that.
Yeah. I mean, they just show it to you like 20 times in your Instagram feed. And then you're like, oh, yeah, actually, I think I really do need that now.
I do need a unicorn with a stripe on the side. I do. Yeah.
Exactly. Who doesn't?
Yeah.
I think it was more a process, like through my own money journey, to actually see that I do have the power. And for example, what I did is I unsubscribed to all the newsletters. You know, if you don't want to get sucked into marketing, then try to not consume it. Mm-hmm. Like, try to not be caught by it in the first place. Like, I had all the newsletters, like every day, like some sale and stuff, and two for one, and all this. All these marketing strategies, which are fine. So I unsubscribed to all the newsletters, and I really, took care of my numbers. Also because I somehow had the vision for my future life that I want to have enough money all the time. If I don't spend it all and I save some of it and maybe even invest it, that came later, that part, I'll be safe and it's fine. And my financial safety is, to me, way more important than the unicorn, right? Mm-hmm. I can buy the unicorn, but just like second step, if everything else is taken care of. I think it's a switch in priorities as well. And I think it's the work you need to do, the reflection work you need to do from unconscious spending to conscious spending. And what you just described to that people buy stuff hoping it will make them happy. Most of the time, the exact opposite happens. You feel guilty. You kind of know it doesn't make you happy, and you know you don't need it. And but people buy it, and then the stuff is at home and you look at it and you're like, oh, damn it, I bought this. I shouldn't have done this. And then you even feel guilty. You don't feel better. You feel guilty.
Yeah.
So not buying it makes you feel better and makes your bank account look better. So I think that's so basic, simple concepts.
It is once you know it. You know, that's the thing is,
yeah,
once
exactly.
once it once clicks you know. In the mind, yeah. and yeah. I think once it clicks experientially too. So for example, once I, in the second book in the Cafe series, the little girl Emma is talking about riding a surfboard, and she says, once I was on that surfboard and I knew what that felt like, it was a lot easier to save for that. And therefore I could say, well, I'm not going to buy these other things because I really want that as part of my life experience.
Yeah.
And so once you know that, it does make the mental transformation a lot easier. The trick, I think, is to close off the marketing side or sort of that piece of our everyday culture long enough that you can get your headspace in the right space. And I'm always curious how people do it. Like, as I said, for me, it was backpacking around the world. That was a huge aha for me. And have you found with your clients that there's an element of experiential like that? for example, I'll give you another example real quick, and then I want to hear your answer. I was working with a guy who was actually in the high finance side. He was helping high net worth clients invest. And he said, I give them the Big Five for Life book because to them, they don't know what they really want to do with their life. But if I can help them get clear on what they want to do with their life, then they can start putting money in those categories.
Exactly.
And so my goal, he said, is to try and get them to sample that, to taste it so that then they can get motivated. And so have you found that to be the case in the work that you do?
Yeah, totally. I think that's actually like one of the most important parts in this whole journey, in this whole financial. I mean, at the end of the day, you take financial decisions like every day, like multiple hundred of financial decisions. You have to make them every day. And, you know, also to not buy something is a decision. And then it's like only actually a matter of priorities. Like, I can spend the euro once. You know, as my grandma used to say, you can only spend it once. Like, on what you want to spend it? You want to spend it on like stupid stuff, or do you want to spend it on your goals? Do you want to spend it on your financial independence? Do you want to spend it on the very nice holiday? Do you want to spend it on this cool event you want to go to? Do you want to spend it on your personal growth? Or do you want to spend it on this nice fancy car you think you need to have because your neighbor has it? Mm-hmm. And I think that, it comes down to your goals, to your vision. And that's something that we do in our programs as well. I think it could just work if you have this emotionally like intense goal. If you really envision, like, why am I doing this? I don't save money because I like it. I like the numbers in the bank account. Like, I like saving because I know what it can buy me in the future. Or know what it can buy me, like, in some weeks or maybe in 40 years. And I think that's a really powerful it's a powerful
it's a concept, it's an awareness.
Yeah exactly. But and I mean, you have to sit down and do it, right? Like, you have to sit down and clear priorities and also clear your values. And also I think, like, very deep down, it's a matter of self-worth. Like, if I'm so like clear on myself, clear on my values, clear that I am worth it, that I am enough, like very deep down, I am enough. I don't need to have this fancy car.
That's amazing.
It's like, it's only if I think I'm not enough, I need to catch up. I need to prove to whoever, nobody cares. I need to prove to whoever that I am worth it and I'm enough. And, you know, with this concept, you're always on the outside. You're always on the outside. You're always buying new stuff to fill this hole of your self-worth because, you don't have any other strategies.
And there's always going to be somebody who has more. Or
yes,
who has something
exactly.
different, or who lives in a different house.
And most of the time, well, it's actually that people don't, right? They have this Mercedes, but actually it's way too expensive for them. So you look at people and you think, oh, they have it all because you see the shiny car and they pretend that they have it all. And you're like, wow, I want to have it all too. I need this Mercedes. And actually they don't. Like, I mean, that's most of the time.
Right.
It's just shiny object syndrome and they have debt up their neck.
Right.
So.
But you don't know from the outside looking at that person what goes on behind the scenes, what goes on behind the closed doors of the discussions.
Totally. And you don't need to, right? Stay in yourself, stay in your zone, in your life, in your vision, where you want to go. And so I think self-worth is a really big part of spending habits at the end of the day.
It's interesting that you're saying that, because as you were talking, my intuition was reflecting on the cafe world and that question of why am I here? And at the end of the day, everyone's going to have their own answer to that question. So for somebody, they may want to be an entrepreneur. For somebody else, they may want to be an adventurer and go travel the world. For somebody, they may want to dedicate themselves to being in the role of the parent for their children, whatever. Everybody gets to pick that, and everybody's got their own answer to that. But it syncs beautifully with what you're just describing, because the more awareness you have about your personal answer to that question, the more comfortable you are in that character, then your own self-worth rises. And in that self-worth rising, what I hear you saying is those are the moments when you see your clients that they don't need, they don't feel the need to then go fill themselves exactly. with other stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the magic is like, you need to be your own benchmark, not somebody else. Mm-hmm. Like the outside is not your benchmark. Like the way you feel, the way you feel about yourself, about your life, about your future, about your vision, about your family. Like if you're satisfied with, or if you're happy with what you have right now and, you know, the vision of your life, then it's all good.
Yeah.
So, and everybody has their own vision of their life. So it's totally different path. And that's not, it doesn't make sense to look at others and see what they have and maybe, you know, need to think that you need to live up to that because they have a different, they have different goals. They have a different vision. It doesn't match with yours. So yeah, and, why do you want to do the same stuff as them? It doesn't make sense.
And different life story. Their backgrounds are going to be totally different. So their motivations are going to be totally different. So that level of self-actualization is, again, going back to your personal story, was that a progressive growth for you? Did you have someone who, either a particular book or a particular person who really helped you understand that if you get yourself figured out, that the rest of the stuff is less relevant?
Well, actually, your books.
No, oh, thank you.
That
was not a leading question, by the way.
That was not a leading question. No, but I mean, it's true. Like your books were my entry point to self-development. A person, I don't know, I don't think like one single person. And actually, I think it's still also for me, it's still a journey. Because to really have this sink in and to really live it and to also like clean your mind and your spirit again from the outside world. I mean, you know, I'm not living in a vacuum.
Right.
Like there's so much always coming from the outside and new opinions and new limiting beliefs from other people and stuff. So for me, it's like constant work to keep this up and to actually always dig deeper. I think self, like personal growth and self-development is, you know, it just doesn't ever end.
I agree. Because the minute you add another variable, then the game changes. Because now you have a whole level of data, distractions, opinions that were never even part of your storyline before. Those are the things that I'm facing now that I never thought about 5 years ago and certainly not 15 years ago. And I can only imagine that 5 years from now, there's going to be something else that is different that I haven't been thinking about. And
exactly.
At the end of the day, I do think that the more grounded you can be, and I think it's important to find your own way to be grounded. So I like the museum day concept because for me, that keeps me centered. Like, okay, if I go in this direction, then looking back over my life, will I be happy with those decisions? Will I be, you know, will I love to walk that wing of the museum or will I look back with regrets that, oh yeah, I headed down that path, but look what I left behind when I did that. And so I think that's one of the keys to life is to find something that helps you anchor so that you don't get as distracted as the game is constantly changing.
Exactly. Yeah. Those simple concepts as a museum, I think that's just brilliant because it helps you reflect every single day. I mean, there can be bad days. I think that's okay. but still, yeah, the way I do it a lot is with like really visioning my life, having my principles, having my values also. And I feel like, I mean, at the end of the day, it's again about making decisions. Like now with my babies, like I need to make totally different, like a different sort of decisions than before. Decisions I've never even thought about. And I think if you have this compass inside of you, like a very simple concept as the museum or as your values or your vision where you want to be in 20 years, or actually what I also like is the funeral speech, like what are people gonna, I think that's also a very strong concept. Like what are people gonna tell about you on your funeral day?
Right.
Like how are they gonna feel about you? Like what are they telling, what you did? What was your character like? I think it's so interesting. And it always has to do with the future. Like, you know, like you project stuff into the future. If it's, you know, going through the museum or at the funeral speech or whatever, I found that people have a hard time like envisioning that stuff because it is, it's very abstract. And you don't have to be able to envision every detail, but the path, like the path itself, with some guiding principles on the sideline so that, you know, okay, I can't really get off track. And even if I go off track, I know how to come back again.
Right.
Yeah, that, I think that's
that core that's infrastructure.
Do
you,
exactly.
Do you have the foundational yeah. elements that no matter what life throws right. at you, as you said, and I think that is so brilliant yeah. And important for everybody to embrace, you're not going to get it 100% perfect. Nobody does. So no matter yeah. how good the infrastructure is, there's going to be moments when you get knocked off course. But yeah. with the right infrastructure, then when you get knocked off course, it takes you less time to get back on course. That to me is what yeah. I think about all the time. It's not about beating yeah. myself up when I get off course. It's shortening the duration that takes from off course to back on course.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think that's, you know, there's a lot of stuff that can help in, you know, staying on course, like your friends, like they have so much impact on you, your friends, your yeah. family, your job, your entrepreneurial stuff that you do, like your energy. it's the system can be built, you know, you don't have to do it by yourself. It's like you need to do the reflection, like, what do I want to do? But then there's so much support on the outside and on the inside that can get you back on track. And I mean, the worst case you don't want to have is like you're 60 years old and you regret stuff you have done or you haven't done. And yeah. that's, and I think that's such a powerful concept.
I've been thinking a lot about the idea of stories yeah. and that when you get very yeah. old, what you have are your stories. And so if you yeah. hang out with people that are not able to do a lot of stuff physically anymore, so they've arrived at a point, but there's like, especially people that have a great sense of life, like they're still very full of the joy of life, but they physically can't do as much anymore. What I've noticed is that they tell a lot of stories, and they're yeah. only able to tell a lot of stories if they did a lot of interesting things, because right. otherwise the entire story would go something like this. And so then for those 10 years, I sat in this little cubicle and I looked at the screen. And sometimes I would move papers back and forth. Yeah, and I typed on that computer thing a lot. Like, that would be a very boring story, like, if that's all yeah. you've got.
It sounds such a waste of time, right?
Yeah.
It's such a waste of time.
You're like,
and
what?
Energy.
For a decade you did that? Or yeah. for 4 decades you did that? And I'm not knocking yeah. it if that is someone's calling. What I'm saying is if that's not mm-hmm. your calling,
right?
Is that the story yeah. that you want to be telling when that's exactly. all you have left are your stories? So
yeah. And it takes a lot of courage to break out, right? I think courage is such an important metric in there that we maybe need to embrace a little more. You know, we talked about you can always go back to a crappy job, yeah?
yeah.
Take the courage and get off that path and go onto your path that's actually yours. So, be brave.
In that regard, I think about what's the worst thing that could happen. It was a piece of advice yeah. someone gave to me many, many years ago. And yeah. I thought it was great advice because it yeah. was at a time when I was struggling to make decisions out of a fear that if it goes wrong, that it'll mm-hmm. be catastrophically wrong. And he said, yeah. listen, he said, why don't you just give some thought to what's the worst thing that could happen and what are the odds that that is actually going to be the way it turns out?
Mm-hmm.
And what I discovered is, yeah. you know, the worst thing that could happen was this, but the odds of that happening were like 2%. And so from a math perspective, and I'm very it's weird because I'm very creative in the writing process, and I'm also very left-brained in my analytics. And for some reason, some things like that just click for me. So when he broke it down into the math for me, I looked at it and I was like, yeah, like that's idiotic on my part to be worrying about the thing that is such yeah. a tiny likelihood to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good concept. Like what's the worst case? And yeah, as you said, most of the times the worst case is not even realistic.
Right.
It just doesn't
right.
happen. Like, yeah. like, what's the worst case? It doesn't work out and you go back to the crappy job where you are right now. So
yeah.
you didn't even lose anything.
So
you learned and you won a lot of experiences. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's it, finding these little data points. And it's funny because you were talking before and something clicked in my mind of a single data point that really changed the way that I viewed saving. And that mm-hmm. was, I think it was a Warren Buffett interview, and he was talking about mm-hmm. that if you have $1,000 and you can invest it in something that gets you 10% a year, that you can either spend the $1,000 today or every year for the rest of your life, you get a $100 check in the mail. So which one sounds, so this would actually be interesting to tie it to the museum, right? Or that forward casting that we're yeah. talking about. And so in this moment in time, You could either spend mm-hmm. $1,000 on whatever you're going to spend it on, or yeah. every year for the rest of your life, you get a check in the mail for $1,000 or for $100. Which one mm-hmm. feels better to you? Which one do you want yeah. to be part of your story? And that was very transformative for me. Mm-hmm. I couldn't believe yeah. that I had been 30 years on the planet and never heard something like that. But nonetheless, yeah. I think I was 32 at the time. Yeah. But that was really a game-changing visualization yeah. concept for me. So, and I know yeah, that no. you have spent mm-hmm. an insane amount of time embedding yourself in thousands of hours of personal study. I saw that you've read over 200 books yeah. on personal finance. So I have yeah. a question as it relates to what I just shared and in general, and that is, yeah. so first of all, after reading 200 plus books on personal finance, at what point do you start to see so many redundancies that you're like, okay, yeah. I can skip chapters 9, 12, 17, 24, yeah. 20. So, I mean, how many were you in before that started to happen? And then also, do you have kind of a short list of these things that were like big aha moments for you, kind of like the 10% on $1,000?
Yeah. So yeah, the 200 books, that was quite a lot. But that was also because I was there in the stage that I was like, I want to do something with it, right? I want to write my own book.
Okay.
And I'm also very analytical and very, yeah, maybe a little perfectionist. I was okay, I have to read all of those books to know what I'm talking about and to write a really good book. Yeah, but, you know, it starts getting redundant pretty soon because, I mean, it's, you always have a kind of a different angle, you know, from women or from children's books or whatever, but the core principles are always the same, right? So for me, one of the biggest aha moments was definitely the pay yourself first concept. I think it was also a quote from Warren Buffett, who said, don't save what's left after spending, spend what's left after saving. And I was like, wow, right, I can save first. Like, and I see this is so common with people who are like, I can't save any money. It's at the end of the month, like nothing is there. It's like, I know, of course nothing is left in the end of the month. Like, put it in front. And I just love the simple concepts. It's like, and then it works. It's a matter of mindset. It's a matter of priorities. Like, if you tell somebody at the end of the month, like, save $100, they're like, I can't, it's not there. But if you tell them, you know, once your money comes in, you take $100 out and put it in your savings account, like automatically, you don't even see it. Then all of a sudden it is possible. Like it's magic.
Yeah. Yeah. Something so simple and profound. But again, until you know it, it's not magic and profound. But once you know it, you're like, whoa. And exactly. It sounds like you're saying once yeah. you build it as a habit too.
Yeah, exactly. You build it as a habit. And the best thing is like that it's effortless, that it's a system, you know, it's a bank account that does it automatically. And so mm-hmm. you don't even have to think about it. So it just runs through. You don't see those $100. They're right. gone. It's, right. it's like a tax. It's like a tax to yourself.
Yeah.
You know, like if this day it would come, it would be like, you know, now we have to raise taxes by 10%. Yeah, you would pay it. Like you have no other chance. So it's a tax to yourself. Yeah. I think that's a very simple concept. And then also the concept of compounding. Like invest your money and it gets more. Like dramatically more, like exponentially more, just by, you know, kind of sitting there and being invested. It's like, what? How? Because at some point there's a tipping point where you actually have more like returns than you actually have to invest. Mm-hmm. So people always think like, and that was also a big aha moment for me, to become a millionaire, you need to make like 5 million and save one. That's not the case. You don't have to earn millions and millions of euros or dollars. Like you have to earn enough so that you can invest so that this then becomes the $1 million. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, you don't have to save it. You invest it and then it becomes more. It's like, what?
Yeah.
You know, all this concept of money is getting more and I don't have to work for it. That's just blew my mind back then.
Like, yeah.
What? How? That's a concept I never learned about as a child or as a teenager. And yeah, it took me, as you said, like 30 years on the planet.
Which is astounding, right? Because you would think that this would be something that is, I actually have questions related to that because now you are a parent and I'm curious yeah. to know.
Yeah.
As someone who's out there helping women, especially in all different walks of life, as you're thinking about helping kids, what is the age at which you think you'll start sharing these concepts that you've embraced and that have changed your life?
Yeah, as soon as possible. I mean, you know, it starts with like pocket money. And also, I mean, children see your behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's so important. It's not only like what systems you implement. It's like they monitor you.
Yeah.
they do what you do. Like
they
you
are
cannot
always
eat
watching.
At McDonald's. Yeah, right. Like you cannot eat your fast food and tell your kid, please eat your salad. No,
right.
It's not working. You cannot not read a single book in a year and tell your kid, oh, you should be reading more. It's like, why? It just doesn't work. So I think it's a big part is involvement, you know, like involving your child in money activities, have their own portfolio in their name and stuff, and really, you know, involve them in decisions, money decisions, like why did we buy this and didn't buy that or whatever, or what are our priorities, like what do we like to spend money on as well. You know, it's not always about saving, it's about priorities. Like I love spending money on convenience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to travel nice. Like I want to take a cab every once in a while if it saves me time. And I will probably start with pocket money. I think you can do that when they're like 4 or 5. They don't really then understand what's happening, but I think it's part of the involvement like early on. And then you can really do like cute stuff, like make some like little boxes, you know, and you give them their pocket money and they put 10 cents to like spending, 10 cents to savings, 10 cents to investing or stuff. You know, you can ask your child, like, you want to spend it on candy now or you want to invest it so that it gets more over time and you can buy more candy or whatever, or something better, the unicorn.
That would be interesting. Yeah. At what age does the idea of that example that we were talking about before, 1,000 today or 100 every year for the rest of your life? Obviously, when you're a little kid, you don't necessarily have that very long timeline perception, but I'd be very curious to know at what age they sort of get that. I did something interesting with my daughter that was, I don't think it was really related to that, which would have been cool now that I think about it. But when kids are, I notice when kids are little, especially here, that they are asking for stuff all the time. And so you walk through a large store, which has a lot of toys. And of course, what kid doesn't, I'd like that. I'd like that. I'd like that. Right. And so I saw other parents struggling with this with kids that were older than mine. And so I was like, all right, what am I going to do when I get to that point? And so I implemented a very simple thing, which has worked out tremendously well. And that is, so she got an allowance. My daughter got an allowance. It was $5 a week. And I said, you get to do whatever you want with this money. Like you are the owner of this money. I think it's awesome if you can tie it into some little chore or something. So there's something that they're responsible. Mm-hmm. So when you're done with dinner, put your plate away or something like that, so that they realize when I do good things that I get rewarded for that. I think that's a positive thing. But anyway, so then anytime that she would say, when she, again, this is like the very early stages, she'd be like, oh, so can I have that toy? And I'd say, well, that's entirely up to you. I mean, you have money in your allowance. Do you feel that you want to spend the money? Yeah. And I would keep the total on my phone. And she would always ask me, Dad, how much do I have in there? I'd say, well, you have $84. I said, so how much is the toy? It's $9. So, well, it's entirely up to you. You have $84.
Yeah.
Do you want to spend $9 of it? This made my life so flippin' easy in terms of that discussion. Because I saw so many, like, kids are having a tantrum on the floor. The parents are yelling. Everybody's frustrated when they get in the car. This solved that entirely.
Yeah. That's so good. And I love how, like, kids or, like, your daughter learns, like taking the responsibility, like you take, you make the decision. It's your responsibility with your money. It's your money. You need, you know, I mean, that's a concept that most adults don't really get. Like it's if you want it or not, like it's your responsibility. So that's a really good concept. And it's about like delaying the gratification, right? Which like nowadays it becomes really, really hard because everything is delivered to your doorstep within 10 minutes.
Right.
So, right.
Yeah.
And no matter what it is, if it's a date, you know, on an online like dating platform, like Tinder or something, or if it's your milk, And how do kids then learn to delay this gratification and to get the benefits of it? That it's really a good idea to save more for later to then be able to, you know, buy something worth more, like a better quality addition to your life. And you know this marshmallow test? Yeah, you probably know that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's also, I think that was with quite little kids that actually took the decision then, okay, yeah, so I don't eat the marshmallow, so I get two.
Right.
You know, that's basically what it's all about.
Yeah. Can you teach them the concept of delayed gratification? And right. You're right. That's a great point. I think the kids were really, really young. Interesting, as you're saying, the waiting, I haven't thought about this in forever, but one of the things, and again, she was quite young when she implemented it, was my daughter came up with a process or a filter. And she said, so my filter is, she was probably like 9 or 10 by the time. So she was past the age of just like, I want that, I want that. And that was kind of a dialogue. But now she was a little older enough to be more processing and thinking. And I was asking her about something and she said, well, I want it now, but I have a thing that I do where if I want something, I wait 30 days and I put it on my phone to remind me in 30 days. And if I still want it in 30 days, then I'll consider buying it. And I was like, holy cow, like that's a great tip. Like it was something she came up with entirely on her own.
Tip.
Yeah.
That's a really expert tip. Like that's a tip that I tell my, people, wait for 30 days.
And I like the idea of putting the reminder on your phone. You know, it's like, the way you feel about it right now, where it's the impulse. And again, that's usually tied to the marketing is probably going to be very different from the way it even feels a day from now, let alone 30 days from now.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I love that your daughter implemented that already.
Yeah. So well, this goes back to what you were talking about earlier, the joy of learning from your own children. That this is not something that I came up with. This was entirely something that she came up with on her own as a reflection of her personality. So
I
think one of the biggest challenges for me in the world of personal finance as my own journey has progressed has been filtering out truth, because there is so much information out there. And it's usually not, depending on the source, it can be manufactured to look a particular way. And so one of the things that just sort of irks me to no end is when I get a very fancy looking brochure from a very, very large financial institution who is touting their latest mutual fund. And they say, and our average return over the last 5 years is this, right?
Yeah.
Because one of the biggest ahas for me, I talk about this in, I think it's the second cafe book where, and I've actually done this with live audiences before, where you say, okay, if I give you $100,000, right, and you're going to invest it and you lose 50% the first year, but you gain 50% the second year. So your average return is zero. Are you okay with that? And people are like, yeah, I guess so. But when you look at the actual math, if you start with $100,000 and you lose 50%, you're down to $50,000. But if you gain 50, now you're only up to 75. You're still down like a lot, right?
Yeah.
And so I get annoyed when I see the data being manufactured and then presented in a marketing format to make it look better than it actually is. So how do you guide yourself and how do you guide your clients to find truth as it relates to their financial investing decisions?
Yeah, very good question. Like, first of all, I encourage them to actually understand like who's making money, how, right? So, I mean, what are they selling to me? What are they selling? Are they selling the mutual fund or are they selling an insurance or like how do they actually make money and what is their interest in me buying this stuff? Like, for example, like one example from my history is I signed some insurance, like pension insurance, and for some reason I thought it was free, right? Because this financial advisor was like, I was like, so what, you know, what does it cost exactly? Like what does your counsel cost right now? She's like, no, it's free. I'm like, huh, cool. Yeah, right. I'll take it. I didn't even think about like, well, if that's free, like how does this person make money? Like how does she live? And of course it was like, you know, getting kickbacks from the insurance, but initially, of course, I pay. Like, how does insurance make money from me? I think once you understand like who is making money from what and what are the interests, like are they acting in my interest? Like, am I paying them up front? or do I get an invoice or whatever? So it doesn't really matter what mutual fund they sell me or what insurance they sell me, because I pay them and they act in my interest. Or is it all for free and all totally independent, and it doesn't cost you anything? It's, you know, not. And so, like, what if it's too good to be true? Like, if you don't understand who's making money off me right now, then it's probably a red flag. You know, people come to me and they're like, "Yeah, I saw this project, and it's 12% interest." And I'm like, "Okay, then what's the risk?" You know, right. It's too good to be true. What's the risk? Like, high returns is high risk, and it could be that you get zero or even below zero. And I think people get caught up in stuff that is too good to be true, right? You know, some of the whole cryptocurrency thing, they all think they were getting millionaires now, like by investing $1,000 or so, because it worked like 20 years ago, but that's, you know, that's over. So I think it takes some kind of like financial savviness to actually look through like what you just said. You know, if you lose 50% and then gain 50%, that's not the same as right. then being at zero again. And but I mean, that's my whole concept. That's my whole concept, to make decisions on your own, right? To understand this stuff, to like, you need to have the knowledge to not be scammed. Mm-hmm. You need to know what you're doing. And then, like, if you and me look at this prospect and be like, okay, that's crap, right? You need the knowledge to actually see that. And most people don't. But I think if you look at like what are their interests, like what are they selling me and why, how do they make money? Do they make money from me or from products they sell me? And if it's too good to be true, then it's not true.
Two things come to mind. So thank you for that. I think that's a very enlightening answer. And in association with that, as I'm thinking about my own journey over the years, I would say, one, do your very best to find trusted sources you can talk to. And when I say trusted sources, I mean a trusted source. So I know that your clients, when they go to you, when they read an article that you write, when they listen to a podcast that you do, they know that you don't have a side interest, which is why you're talking about this topic. So they know that they can actually listen to you with a clear filter and not have to worry about that. So whether it is Natasha or someone else, find someone who is a genuine trusted source who's genuinely interested in making sure that you are successful. And the second thing that came to mind, and this is something I struggled with for such a long time, was be willing to ask the tough questions. Like, if you don't understand it, don't sign it.
Yeah.
If you don't understand it, don't invest in it. And I was always afraid that, like, gosh, I'm just a nobody and like, this is so outside of my ability to understand it. I guess I'll just follow along, because they seem to really know what they're talking about. Like that when I was a lot younger in my early 20s, late teens, I would sort of let that information bulldoze me. But if your instinct is telling you there's a question that should be asked here, don't feel afraid of looking stupid. Just ask the question, because if you're getting that instinctual call, there's probably something there.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, finding a person you trust can also be hard, right? It's like you trust the financial advisor that has counseled your whole family for the last 20 years, right? It's like you trust them because you think they are an expert, and maybe they are, but maybe, not 100% in your interest, right? Or maybe they sell you stuff they think would be best for you, but maybe they aren't. And I'm not saying that they are doing this on purpose, but it, you know, it happens. And at the end of the day, it again comes down to, it's your responsibility. And it's your responsibility, like, nobody, like, you sign this stuff, right? It's your money, it's your responsibility. And also for asking the right questions. Yeah, totally. I, like, when I was sitting in this office and this lady asked me, so do you have any questions? I was like, I probably should have questions, but I didn't understand what you were telling me, right? So actually being able to ask the right questions, you need some form of knowledge, like what to ask, right? So even Even if you decide to go with some kind of financial advisor or stuff, you need to know the basics to actually be able to ask those super important questions, as you just said. Yeah.
And I think, so you just raised a really unbelievable point, because I saw in your bio information when you sent it to us that, or maybe it was on your website, you were talking about the number of people who are in a dire financial situation as a pensioner, for example, someone who has reached age 60, especially women.
Yeah.
And that they know it's a problem. They know they have a lack of knowledge, but they just put it to the side because they don't want to deal with it. They're afraid to deal with it, or they feel insecure about it, or they just think like, this is not the most fun thing for me to be thinking about today. And I'm curious to know, how many hours do you think it would require of personal investment, either reading other books, listening to your podcast, whatever, before someone had enough of a baseline of knowledge that they could sit in that meeting that you're talking about and not feel intimidated?
Yeah.
Not that they're a pro, not that they're a complete expert, but they at least have enough knowledge that they feel comfortable in that space.
And I think that should also be the goal. Like, you don't have to be a pro. You don't have to study finances, right? You actually just need the basic knowledge, maybe a little more than that. But, you know, people always think like they have to be the best experts in the world, like, to do the personal finance. That's not even necessary. So like, my program is for, and I'm, you know, I'm really keen on efficiency. the best, fastest, most efficient way should be the way, especially when it comes to finances. And so that's, you know, that's why I implemented this program, and it's 8 weeks, but it's not full-time. It's like 8 weeks. And I would say on average, people spend maybe like 5 to 7 hours a week. So, you know, it's not actually that, you know, some need more, some need less, but overall it should be, I don't know, somewhere between like maybe 70 hours or so. Right. So, it's actually not super much. And then people tell me, yeah, but I don't have time. And I'm like, yeah, well, you know, same with money. Time is also a matter of priority. Like, okay, I get that you're scrolling through Instagram like 2 hours a day, but maybe one is also fine. 1 hour is also fine, and you can do, you know, more important stuff with the extra hour you just gained. And again, there, the pay yourself first, as we just said, with, I think there's so many parallels between like money and time. It's all priorities at the end of the day. So plan your day first, plan your week, and put in those blockers for the really important stuff, because otherwise they won't get done. You know, they would just, the time would just fly away. And I think that's a very important point there as well. So you don't have to study for 5 years. You know, it's like, as I said, 8 weeks with like, I don't know, maybe like five to seven hours a week.
Yeah. So I mean, doing the quick math there, so it's close to like 52. So 8 times 7 would be 56 hours, but let's say you do a tiny bit faster. So let's say 52 hours of time, one hour per week. And at the end of that year, right, if you like really dragged it out, but at the end of that year, you're going to feel so much more comfortable about your own future. Because to me, it's the big aha for me as it related to finances was taking back my freedom. Because when you're in the situation where you feel you have to go to work every day, and that's the words that you use. Yeah. Someone says, oh, you want to go, you know, you want to go surfing tomorrow, or you want to go to Costa Rica for a couple of weeks? No, I have to go to work, right? It's the have to. And so it's completely out of my control. I have no freedom whatsoever.
Yeah.
There's major consequences if I don't do this. I have nothing to say about it. That is one of the worst feelings ever. And I think it's the opposite of what we're wired for as a human being. Yeah. And so even if it took you 1 hour a week over 52 weeks, but at the end of that year, for the rest of your life, you'd have this level of comfort that you know how to craft your own freedom as it relates to money, which is one of the biggest challenges people have. Like, that is an insane gift to give yourself. And so whether it's reading books or whether it is taking the mentoring program with you, I just think that, and I don't know any other way to encourage people other than just saying it, that this is something that you want to do, whatever your field of interest it is, invest in yourself and your education so that you can get those benefits for the rest of your life. It just pays all the way through. It's a little bit like the, I invest $1,000 now and I get 100 for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Like investing your time in learning something, you get to use that knowledge, whatever it is, whether it's learning how to surf or play golf or more knowledge about money, like you get to use that for the rest of your life. There's a huge payback on that kind of investment.
Yeah, it's always the best investment. It's the highest ROI. It's just the ROI, like the return on your investment is just insane. As you just said, like it's some hours and it's done for the rest of your life. I mean, I'm not saying that if you do it once, you never have to touch it, but it's going to be so much more easy and it's going to be fun. You know, people are like, well, I found the fun in my finances. Well, it's actually fun, you know, to play around with the numbers and to see and look and also observe other people, how they do it and be like, oh, I'm doing it better. You know, it's like, it's like a whole new world and you understand, you understand concepts better, you understand the economics better, you understand decisions from other people, you understand yourself better. And it's freedom. And it's also like regarding what you said earlier about the poverty in retirement, it's also about safety, right?
Yeah.
It's about safety and about freedom, taking your time back. And I was kind of laughing when you said, I have to go to work. That's something that my parents always say, like, Natasha, you have to work do you have to work today? It's like, no, I do work, but I don't have to work. It's like, but it's so inside, like the whole system, it's have to work, it's a duty. It feels heavy, you know?
Right.
And that's something I didn't want for my life.
Well, that's the opposite of the lightness and the freedom that you find when you have the knowledge to craft your own future and to chart your own path, as opposed to feeling like it's completely outside of your influence. That's the essence of the energy that I want to convey to anybody who's listening. Because I've been on the other side of this where I felt so intimidated in terms of like charting your own financial future. And it is a very freeing experience to understand enough that you see the way in which you can win the game. That is, I think that's the essence of it as I'm saying it out loud. You want to understand the rules and you want to see how you can win the game, and it gives you the power back. That to me was the great joy as I got a bit smarter about this. I would imagine after 3,000 people through your mentoring program, after all of your podcasts and all the things that you've done, that you have some insane stories, because you've got 12 million downloads on your podcast, which is incredible. Are there one or two stories that stand out to you that you really think about on that, on a day when you're having a tough day, you reflect back on this one particular person or this one particular story, and that's what really brings it all home for why you do what you do?
Yeah. Oh, there's so many of them. Like, when I thought about this question at first, I actually had a moment, like when I started this, when I did the first program. We always do an event for the people that, you know, went through the program. And the first event was with like 15 women or so in my co-working space. And I was standing on a chair. That was my stage. I was standing on a chair and like talking to some of them. And the last event we had was like with hundreds of women, and I was standing on the stage, and people were looking at me as like, wow, this is so cool. Like each and every one has their story, has come so far from A to B, from I don't even know where to start to, okay, now I'm like totally financially safe. I know what to do. And there's so many stories. Me personally, I always find the one, involving children, like, of course, very emotional. So there was this one, this one lady was, was let down by her husband. And she was like all the negative stuff you could imagine, right? They were sharing a house, but it was only just his house. You know, he built it and his name was only in the contract, and she didn't even know. It's just, and she was taking care of the children, and she didn't have her own bank account. It was only his bank account. And he was giving her like pocket money to also take care of the children and stuff. And you know, of course, I want to say, of course, you know, everyone knows where this is heading. He left her with, I don't know, somebody else. It doesn't really matter. And she was in, well, but you know, how should I now, like, our children, like, what should I do? Yeah, you can use your own money. And she was like, I don't have own money.
Wow.
Like, he took away her like credit card stuff, didn't give her any money anymore, and she had to move out because it was his house. And I was like, oh my God, this is so, and so many women don't realize that they are in some form of this situation, better or worse, right? This whole dependency on other human beings, mostly it's the partner. And I think they had maybe even 3 children. So I was like, okay, wow, this is really, really intense. And I think they moved in with her parents or what. I mean, the cool thing about the story is women always figure it out, right? It's like we figure it out. Like it has to work out somehow. But then, you know, she was going through my program and told me her story. And I said, wow, this is why I do this.
Yeah.
And she was able, you know, to actually, as you just said, like, take the power back and invest in your freedom, right? This is on so many levels on her story. Freedom, you know, to have her own will again, freedom to have her own life again, freedom to be able to provide for her kids, for her family. I mean, she had nothing. She had actually nothing and started from the bottom. And I think there's so many stories from women who experience exactly this. And sometimes it takes this shock from the outside that they're like, okay, wow, I was just woken up, like, this can't be. But my wish would be that it doesn't have to be this shock from the outside, you know, so that women actually care for themselves financially, and no matter, like, where you live, whose house it is or whatever, that you have your own money, especially when kids are involved. And that's basically what she did. And starting from nothing, it's really tough, right? Like, she started saving also to take part in my program. I mean, it's not for free, right? And but she set a goal and gave herself, I think, 5 months to save for the program. And then did it and came out like a different woman on the other side. It was just, I can literally see her. Like, we have this live calls on Zoom as well, where I then coach them. And the first impression of her was, it was in a really dark room. You know, she looked like she hadn't slept for like 2 months or so. Like, you could see something was very, very wrong. And then the last call I had with her, she was just lit up. Like,
that's beautiful.
The room was light. She was sitting on I think she had flowers. She had some pictures on the wall, just tiny, the little things. I was like, oh wow, you have changed. And that is something that hit me right there, was like, it's not about money. I have a money program, but it's not about money.
Right.
So money is a vehicle. It's about finding yourself. It's about standing up for yourself. It's about your self-worth. It's about gaining your power, back, and designing your life with money. So you need it for that. But it's so much more than numbers in your bank account. Like, it's your life for you, for yourself, and for your family. And that's I think really there, that's the point where money gets really emotional, right? It's highly emotional topic.
That is an amazing story. And I can, as you're describing it, I can see in my mind the images of that woman, and how the darkness that you saw on the screen was certainly a reflection of how she felt about the whole life experience at that moment. Very betrayed and struggling and trying
shocked.
To figure it out and shocked.
Yeah.
And I would imagine someone like that who then makes the decision that they are going to chart, and of course with a great motivation, because our kids are our greatest motivation to, like, make this right, you know? And so I would imagine someone like that is an incredible student, because they are incredibly, incredibly motivated and driven. If they can get beyond the beaten down aspect of, like, they don't trust anyone and they don't even trust themselves at that point.
Right.
And so how beautiful that vision that you have of her now, when you see her as someone who does see the world through a very, very different lens in terms of what they're capable of personally, in terms of what life is capable of being for them. I think that's amazing.
Exactly. And I think it's also like leaving stuff behind, right? Yeah, you've made some bad decisions, right? But it's, you know, it's a courage to accept that and be like, yeah, that was some not so good decisions. I know it now. Back then I didn't really see it, but now I'm taking the responsibility. Like this is zero again, right? I'm starting from here now, going onward with it. And I thought also it's a beautiful story. And that's what she said as well, that her children have gone through the process with her and see, and they saw what she has done, like how she took this challenge of having nothing and then making something out of it. And that, I think that's such a great life lesson beyond, you know, personal finance and stuff, but actually seeing your mom struggling, but taking the responsibility and turning it into growth, right? I think that's such, and I think for those children must have been a life lesson there, like consciously and unconsciously.
In the fourth book in the Cafe series, I love the character of Max. He's just this incredibly wise, the guy who's very old, and he's a little bit grumpy at times, but he's so full of wisdom. And when he's talking to Hannah, who's 15 and comes from a very rough household, and he says to her, sometimes presents come in unpleasant packaging. And the trick is to open the package, realize what it is, learn from it, and then move on.
Yeah.
And so if we spend all our time looking in the rearview mirror, lamenting the decisions we made, which weren't the right ones, but never actually moving forward, then that is where the story is going to end for us. That is where the character arc stops. And that's a travesty, because we all have the capacity to grow beyond those moments where we made a decision that wasn't the best, but we didn't know at the time. At the time, it seemed like the right decision.
Yeah. While you were talking, this quote came to my mind, which I totally love. I think I read it just a couple of years ago. It goes something like, if you're going through hell, keep going. Why would you stop in hell? Right?
Oh, like, that's so good.
Yeah. Why would you stop in hell?
Why stop there? Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, I love
keep
that.
Keep going.
One.
Yeah.
And I think love that one.
Yeah.
I have two more quick questions for you. We've been on for a long time. This has been an amazing discussion. I'm so grateful for the chance to have this. We are covering a lot of my questions, certainly not all of them. We might have to do round two of this at some point if you're open and available.
Sure, I'm up for that.
but I've noticed something when I spend time. I know that you primarily serve a German-speaking audience in Germany, Austria, Switzerland, I would imagine. When I've been there over the last 10 years, I've noticed a real growth in that entrepreneurial spirit. And sort of take charge of my own life. I know that the clients you serve are of mixed ages. I'm just curious, do you see, because I know that part of your purpose is to create an awareness about taking back your power as early as possible in your life, or even not taking it back, but taking your power if you haven't given it away yet. Do you see that is more of the trend with younger people, younger women in particular?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, but I'm in my bubble, right?
Right.
I'm also in my bubble of women who do want this. But especially the entrepreneur side, I see a lot of uplift in that. Also, like a lot of women go through my program and are like, okay, I need to make my money, right? Because it's not enough. Like my job doesn't pay well enough to gain actually financial independence for me and my family. So a lot of them are like, I need a side hustle or something similar to make more money. I see that that is happening. And also, apart from that, you know, becoming an entrepreneur or like not being in some corporate job is so much easier today, right? I mean, you can be a YouTuber.
Right. Yeah, there's there's an unbelievable growth in the ways in which you can add your genius to the world, whatever it is.
Exactly.
And make money off
of it. Right. So I do see more, let's say, more awareness that this is also an option.
Okay.
Right. My parents didn't have this option. Like they didn't, well, they did have it theoretically, but they didn't see it. So the younger generation right now, I think they see it very well as an option. And also like when it comes to investing into startups, especially in Berlin, there are also some investors who are only investing in women-owned startups and stuff. So I see a lot of stuff going on there.
That's awesome.
In the meanwhile, still, most of the capital actually goes to male founders because most of the investors are male and invest into guys. But yeah, I see a shift, especially in Berlin. I'm in Berlin, and that's pretty much a startup.
That's fantastic. I think I maybe have not hit one of them. So I said there was just two questions left, but I think maybe there's one that I wanted to ask for sure, because I would imagine people who are intrigued by our conversation that they want to take their life in the direction of being the controller of their own destiny, especially as it relates to personal finance. So super short question, and then I want to ask. So I'll ask you both questions at the same time. How's that? That way I'll get it out of my system.
Sounds awesome.
The first one is there a particular 1, 2, 3 books that you would recommend someone reads if they are in the situation of this conversation has intrigued them, they want to take that power in terms of their personal finances back and start there? So that's my first question. And my second question is very personal to you. I'm just curious, like, you've been on this amazing journey. We covered part of it, but there's been so much more that we didn't even get a chance to talk about. I'm just curious, like, what gets you excited looking forward for yourself? Or are you just able to embrace the moment right now in the role that you're in as a mom, as an entrepreneur, helping these people? So those are my final two questions. And
all right.
I would love to hear your answers.
All right, let's go. So 3 books that I would definitely recommend. Well, it's a classic, like Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki. I think that's a good basics and also mindset book. Then for the ladies, for the women, Prince Charming Isn't Coming from Barbara Stanley. Great title. Yeah, that's best reason to buy it as well. No, it's a really good book. And also by Amanda Steinberg, Worth It. It's also directed to women. So Prince Charming Isn't Coming, Richard Put It, and Worth It. I think that's, well, and 4 bonus, my book, right? It's only in German. And what's my plan? What's my vision? Like, I think with Madame Moneypenny, we have a lot of work still to do. So that's definitely the vision or the project, my life project that I want to embrace further, and then that I want to grow even further also in the terms of personal development, not only finance, but personal development and growth and stuff. Because I find that for a lot of people, finance is just the first step, and they see that there's so much more they can do with their life. And that this topic actually just opens their view to personal growth and personal finance. So, and at the same time, I'm pretty happy where I am right now, like also as a mom.
That's awesome.
I just love it. And of course, that's my focus right now and my first priority. But I think in the whole like topic of female empowerment, there's so much more to do. And I truly believe that our world would be so much better with more empowered women in all kinds of important positions and situations. So I'm really keen on empowering more women, more young girls, maybe as well. And I think it's a mix to embrace what is right now and to really enjoy the time with my little family, and also going beyond and to serve the community. Yeah.
I love that. Yeah, I will tell you, so as someone who's a little bit farther along the parenting track, the years, and I'm sure everybody tells you this, but the years fly by. And there's markers along the way. So when they're super little like yours, then there's just this incredibly cute, you're in diapers still. And then there's going to come a phase when, they're just talking a mile a minute, but right now you still get to hold them. And then there's going to come a point when they're about 7, you can't even hold them. They're too big. You don't get to hold your kid anymore.
Yeah.
And
no.
I know. And so very much like, because you were talking, we were talking about so many different areas of our personal museums and finance and the rest of that. But to me, having that awareness of what the future will look like, even with your kids, is a great way that it keeps you focused on creating the moments that you want to create now, very much like the money discussion that we were having.
Yeah.
And I think in part that comes from talking to people who have kids that are a little bit older. In part, that comes from just taking the time to step back in a quiet moment and reflect on just how fast things are going and how fast it will continue to go. And I hate to break this to you, but there actually comes a point where it starts to accelerate even faster when they get to be about 11 or 12 years old, because then you've only got them for another certain amount of years before they go off to university.
Right.
And I think it's awesome that you're embracing the fantastic experience in that part of your museum in the moment that you have it now.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Well, thank you for doing all that you do. As a father of a daughter, I'm grateful that there are amazing people like yourself that are creating opportunities for young women, older women to find their freedom, to grab their freedom back in all these different aspects. I'm very, very honored that you're out there doing it. As a final thought, people who are intrigued by this conversation, where can they stay more connected or get more connected with you? What would you recommend for them?
Yeah, I mean, there's a podcast that's also under the name Madame Moneypenny or Natasha, and probably Instagram. Yeah, so feel free to reach out to ask me your questions on Instagram. Just send me a DM, slide into my DMs, and we'll take it from there. Yeah, that's probably both a good channels, and also the website. There's a lot of, I think we have over 200 articles written down there, and lots of insights, lots of free knowledge, personal finance. You find that at madamemoneypenny.de.
Fantastic. Well, right. Natasha, this has been an absolute joy. It's funny how time can fly. Time is such an interesting little thing, because sometimes it can fly by and sometimes it can drag by. And this has been a very, very fast hour and a half.
I know. Yeah.
I'm so grateful again that we've had a chance to take this time, and thank you for carving out time in your very busy life as an entrepreneur, a mom, a seeker in the world to have this conversation. I really feel that there's going to be a lot of folks who listen to this and the wisdom that you've shared, and it's going to be a transformative moment for them. So I am very, very grateful.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me, John. As I said, it's just a huge honor and the biggest fangirl moment in my life so far to being able to talk to you. It means a lot to me, means the world. So thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. We'll have to make it the first of a future one too. And looking forward to our paths crossing in person someday, next time I'm in Berlin. Nice.
All right. Thank you so much, John.
Absolutely. Take care.
Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Ja, ich hoffe, ihr konntet auch aus dieser Folge wieder einiges mitnehmen. Ich fand das Gespräch hier super inspirierend. Denkt dann noch oft dran zurück, und wir planen auch noch eine zweite Version aufzunehmen. Schaut super gerne bei John im Podcast vorbei. Da sind viele spannende Interviewgäste. Und wenn euch diese Podcast-Folge gefallen hat und der Podcast insgesamt, dann hinterlasst mir doch gerne eine 12-Sterne-Bewertung auf Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wo auch immer ihr so unterwegs seid. Darüber freue ich mich sehr. Vielen Dank und bis zum nächsten Mal.